The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Kurt Benroot from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Sci-Fi. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi. This story is called You Are Not the Hero of This Story, and it's by Caroline M. Yoakum. This is a story everyone has heard many times before. It begins with a dragon. Now, you are not the dragon. Dragons are scaly creatures that breathe fire, and you have soft skin and breathe air that smells like whatever you ate for lunch. The dragon, which is definitely not you, is coiled around the base of a tower. You are not the tower because it is an inanimate object. I shouldn't have to tell you this. Inside the tower is a princess. As you might have guessed, you are not the princess. She conforms to some societal construct of what it means to be a perfect woman. You are too masculine or too fat or your skin is too dark. If you are looking for yourself in this story, you'll need to look elsewhere. Besides, you don't want to be the princess anyway. All she does is wait to be rescued. And how boring is that? Somewhere in the kingdom, there's a hero. You'd like to be the hero so you can have adventures and help people. It would be nice to be admired for your bravery, but obviously you are not the hero of this story. The standard characteristics of a hero are different than those required to be a princess, but you definitely do not have them. The hero, who is absolutely, positively not you, kills the dragon and saves the princess. No one is surprised. They've heard it all before. They don't notice that you aren't in the story. It will never occur to them to ask why. You are the hero of another story, and it is a far more interesting story. I hope you tell it. And I hope that people will listen.
I'm Emily Chiola, and I will be reading How to Make a Medusa by Ziggy Schutz. Alina was always told she would really be something when she grew up. A looker, say the adults, tugging at her hair like they can help it grow. Alina sits and stares at the mirror in the hallway, the full-length one that reaches up into the sky, stares and stares because if she is going to be a looker, she better have the eyes to match. Every day she stares, until her eyes start to bulge from their sockets, and she notices she can see things in the dark corners of rooms no one else can. By the time she can almost reach the sink on her own, they are talking about her boyfriends. How she's going to be gorgeous, but probably a handful. At school, the boys pull at her pigtails, and she hisses at them. Everyone laughs. She sits in front of the mirror. Her mother asks if she'd like to try on any of Mommy's makeup. She lets her mother put red on her lips, then licks it all off. She wants to be scary, scary enough that no one will ever touch her hair again. She doesn't want to fit in anyone's hand. She grows. Her hair gets curlier and curlier, and her mother braids it as close to her head as she can, complaining about how she got her father's hair. Alina looks at her braids in the mirror, capped with beads to make them rattle. She hisses, practicing. There's still a bit of lipstick on her front tooth. At school, they tell her to watch for men with strange faces and grabbing hands, but her classmates are just boys being boys. Alina hates them, the men who tell her to smile and the boys who push and pull. She goes to the mirror, makes faces into it until everything about her is sharper. She doesn't want to be a looker anymore. She wants to make everyone stop and stare. The next time one of the boys at school touch her, it's to grab her arm. She screams and gets told that girls shouldn't raise their voices. The boy calls her a liar, and she bites her tongue until it bleeds. They both get in trouble, have to sit across from each other in the hall outside of the principal's office. "Your hair looks like snakes," spits the boy. She stares at him, thinks of stone, and hisses. For a moment, the fear makes him freeze. It makes something in her writhe. Alina is tall now, stretching for the top of the mirror. She smiles, forked tongue framed by needle teeth. Her braids bounce with each step she takes, her eyes a little too large and a little too dark. People still stare, but they don't shout barbed compliments from the sidewalks anymore. There's something about Alina that awakens some primeval fear. No one wants to meet her eyes. She will devour this world whole, jaw unhinging with a hiss.
This story is titled Survivors by M. Bernardo. Nobody ever asked me the secret to survival. You didn't ask either, but I'll tell you anyway. It's cowardice, Ohana. That's how we'll survive. You and I and all the others in our cave with a million tiny acts of cowardice. I didn't start out as Japanese. I'm still not sure if I am, despite what everyone seems to think. The Okinawan soldiers who found me in the crater, the student nurses who brought me juice and sticky slices of mango at the hospital, the thin doctor with the mustache who says he is my father, and you too, Ohana. None of you seem to notice that I am 6 feet tall, with blonde hair and blue eyes. None of you seem to notice I only speak and understand English, with a couple of words in Polish. Somehow I understand you, though. I don't know how. I can even read the characters on the brass dog tag strapped around my chest under these hospital pajamas. There's no name on it, just a company, a unit number, and my own serial number. I could be anybody, but you tell me that my name is Aragaki-san. I guess that's what you would have called the Japanese soldier who jumped into the crater beside me. Meanwhile, the thin doctor with the mustache calls me Isamu. I guess that's what he called his son. I was American to begin with, either in reality or in some vivid dream. I came from Milwaukee, the son of Polish immigrants. When I reported to the draft board, bitter, sullen, my stomach full of ice, the officer there looked at the collision of Z's and S's and K's in my name and said, "We're fighting this war for you, son." It was 4 years since the invasion of Poland and 2 since Pearl Harbor, but I didn't contradict him. I didn't say, "Don't fight for me, I don't want your war." Instead, I said, "Yes, sir." It was the first of many tiny acts of cowardice, the first of many tiny steps I took to survive the war. I liked the first hospital best before we evacuated to this cave, before the Americans got so close. The Americans? We Americans? Either way, I liked the low stone walls, the wooden ceiling, and the cool sea breeze through the open windows. I liked the thin doctor with the mustache, too, the one who calls me Isamu, the one who says he is my father. I fear he's dead now, blown up with the rest of the hospital and patients who couldn't be moved. He would have stayed with them. He was no coward. I liked you, Ohana, and the rest of the student nurses. You said you came from high school, along with your teachers and classmates. You said you brought your books to study, laughing and thinking the war would be over in a matter of days. How long ago was that? Months? Years? Eternities? I wonder if my American unit had already landed on Okinawa by the time you joined up as a nurse. I wonder if I was in the crater with that Japanese soldier, the one who must have been called Aragaki Isamu. I wonder if I was Japanese already. I wonder if I was on my way here. You want to hear about my million acts of cowardice? They're very much alike, but first you must imagine we're in battle. I rattle my gun at you, and you rattle your gun at me, each of us afraid that the other will rattle it first. I hear that some of the Japanese are carrying sharpened sticks or bamboo poles. We hear that some of them are peasant boys pressed into service, younger than our own kid brothers. But still I rattle my gun, rat-a-tat-tat. It jumps and jerks in my hands. I don't stop to see who's coming. If they have a rifle or a broomstick, rat-a-tat-tat. They fall like stalks of wheat. We hear that there are civilians hiding in the caves. We hear there are nurses and wounded with them. But I shoot my Tommy gun and I hurl my grenades. I hang back on the charges and never take point. I never volunteer for anything. I didn't ask for this war. I didn't ask to be here. But I am, and I am trying to survive. It could have been you, Ohana. If things had turned out differently, I could have rattled my gun at you. In frenzy and fear, I could have hurled my grenade into this cave. Did I tell you about the crater, Ohana? That was another of my million acts of cowardice, but passive that time, not active. The Japanese soldier flopped down not 10 feet from me, seeking shelter the same as I was. My gun was jammed, half taken apart in my hands, and he flopped down over the rim. Just him and me, alone in that crater where a bomb had exploded days before. I looked at him, but there was nothing I could do. He looked at me, but he never raised his gun. Seconds ticked by, and explosions thudded around us. Shouts, screams, the pinging and whizzing of bullets. What a god-awful mess. What a god-awful sound. But still the seconds passed. 2, 3, 4, 5. That's an endless eternity in battle. He could have cut me in half a dozen times over. I would have done it almost as a reflex if my gun hadn't been lying in my lap in 3 pieces. Rat-a-tat-tat, and I survive a few minutes longer until the next crisis in cowardice. Yet he never moved. He never raised his gun. We just sat, looked at each other, eye to eye. Then the grenade dropped into the crater. There were the two of us now, and one live grenade. I saw it first, watched it arc gently through the air and land with a plop in the mud, sticking fast exactly where it fell. A second later, he saw it too. I don't know if it was instinct or choice, Ohana, but down he went. He fell on that grenade, his arms squeezed tight to his sides to keep the blast in, and then he screamed. And somehow, I woke here, where you all say, I am him. You know how the thin doctor with the mustache cried when he saw me? You were there. You know how he always said he was my father. He never needed a dog tag to recognize me. I prayed for you to come here, he said, squeezing my hand. I prayed to see you again. But he couldn't be the father of a Polish boy from Milwaukee. He couldn't be the father of a cowardly American soldier who had never before been to this place. But still he sat and squeezed my hand. Still he cried when he saw me alive. I'm not the boy you think I am, I said. I didn't fall on the grenade. It doesn't matter, Isamu, said the doctor. He must have thought I was full of the usual guilt and shame of surviving soldiers. He must have thought I believed I should be dead. It doesn't matter, my son. But he didn't understand, Ohana. It matters that his real son jumped, and I didn't. I'd have done the same even if I'd been in the crater with my unit. It wasn't because I saw him as an enemy that I failed to try to save him. I wasn't thinking American or Japanese. I wasn't thinking friend or foe. All I was thinking was how to get out, how to save myself. And all he was thinking was how to save me. I don't know why I was spared, Ohana. I don't know why I've come here, why I've been given my enemy's father's hand to hold. My enemy? What a strange word. My nightmare, more like. My fear. My boogeyman that would have cut me down if I didn't properly complete the rituals I learned to protect against him. The rituals of pointing and squeezing, of pulling a pin and throwing. Why else had we repeated them so many times if they were not rituals and talismans to us, religious practices to expel our demons? There are wounded here in our cave. There are soldiers and civilians. There are students like you who left their schools to be nurses. Already in my mind's eye, I can see the grenade tumbling through the rock cleft. Already I can see it skittering out onto the cave floor. I can see your frightened face, Ohana, and hear the American voice yelling, "Fire in the hole!" I see myself waiting, again, for someone else to make the sacrifice. I told you already, Ohana, that the way to survive a war is with a million tiny acts of cowardice. But perhaps there is another way. If a grenade falls among 10 men... and all of them are cowards, then all 10 will die. But if even one of them is courageous, then the other 9 will live. But I've talked too long, Ohana. I've said too many things that don't make sense. Psst! Quiet! There's someone outside the cave. Will he be courageous or cowardly, Ohana? Will he stop to see if we are soldiers or not? Aragaki Isamu would surely have checked. He would have looked before he shot, as he did when we sat in the crater together. Am I so lucky to meet another soul as courageous as he? Quiet! Quiet, Ohana! With empty hands, now I go to find out.
Hello, this is Robbie Merritt. I'm going to be reading The Seven Habits of Highly Effective Monsters by Alex Schwartzman. It isn't easy being green, scaly, or abominable these days. Humanity turned the tables on the apex predators of the food chain and has been exterminating us with extreme prejudice. We're still faster and stronger than they are, but we're prone to defeat by bad judgment. Heed the lessons of our vanquished brethren, learn from their mistakes, and remain successful, extant, and satiated. 1. Don't rely on henchmen. There's no denying that it's emotionally satisfying to be worshipped, or at least obeyed by humans. However, there's little practical benefit. In the entire history of henchmen, cultists, minions, lackeys, and worshippers, one is hard-pressed to come up with a single paragon of effectiveness. Instead, they tend to be slow, dim-witted, and clumsy. At best, your followers might mildly inconvenience your adversary as he or she rampages through your lair or secret laboratory, sharp object, or destiny in hand. At worst, they might develop last-minute regrets and attempt to throw you down the nearest shaft. So, next time someone else asks if you're a god, just eat them. 2. Heed the warning signs. Ignoring the obvious means you're just asking for trouble. For example, vampires and other beings highly allergic to vitamin D are advised to steer clear of towns with the word sunny in their name. That's just common sense. There are plenty of better targets, places with names that evoke gothic dread and despair. Names like Glooming Creek, Murky Hollow, Gloomsburg, or Detroit. 3. Be aware of your surroundings. Don't climb skyscrapers. There's little room to maneuver up there, and the position isn't defensible. If your adversary is running away, they're almost certainly leading you into a trap. Pre-plan your retreat. Always know the shortest route to the nearest sewer, secret passage, or interdimensional portal. If retreat isn't an option, pretend to be their friend. A surprising number of humans will fall for a few sparkles and a tortured expression. 4. Practice safe invading. When invading alien planets, be sure that all your vaccinations are up to date. Your mothership's operating system shouldn't be compatible with the latest in Earth's computer virus technology. Whatever resources you seek on Earth, water, oxygen, landmass to terraform, are cheap and plentiful elsewhere in the universe. If you've achieved interstellar flight, your robots are probably safer, smarter, and longer lasting than human slave labor. 5. Mix it up. Adjust your tactics to keep your nemesis guessing. It's okay not to eat the lone black guy first. The rest of his party will never expect it if you start with someone else. Stab your adversary in the middle of explaining your nefarious plan to them. Don't place your calls from the inside the house. 6. Hunt safely. On average, few modern humans have access to the silver bullets, pitchforks, or wooden stakes soaked in holy water. And probably the odds of anyone who encounters a monster possessing such items rise exponentially. Always comport yourself as though everyone has access to the one thing that can pierce your otherwise indestructible skin or body armor. 7. Even if you meticulously prepare your schemes and pay careful attention to the safety tips above, at the end of the day, you must ask yourself, is it really worth it? The most dangerous monster of all is man. For best results, avoid encounters at all costs.
This story is titled, This is a Science Fiction Story About the Day After Tomorrow by Pat Stansberry. This is a science fiction story about the day after tomorrow. No aliens will arrive on Earth to enlighten or enslave us. There will be no traveler from the future warning of impending Armageddon. No shadowy government agency will reveal unheard-of technologies, a new space plane or spy drone or stealth ship. Absolutely nothing of that sort will occur. Some other things will not happen. A megalomaniacal technology tycoon will not try to conquer the planet. There would be no money in running it. No messiah will come to raise the world from squalor, greed, and hate. He, she, or it has had plenty of time to act and more than enough provocation. A theoretical physicist will not, for 5 short seconds, comprehend the unified structure of the universe. Afterwards, he will not wonder if it had been a true epiphany or merely a brief euphoric state brought on by exhaustion. The universe might be beautiful and elegant, but it is not that simple. Here's what will happen. Dai Sato will return from Japan for the first time in 68 years, having left in fear and shame shortly after the war. It was in Geneva where he watched newsreels of General Tojo's trial, of American troops strutting through Tokyo, debasing the memory of his father and cousins and uncles who died on Pacific Islands. Yet the day after tomorrow, he will stand at Shibuya Crossing, the busiest intersection in all the world, and be spellbound by the power of this new and vital Tokyo. His countrymen have achieved greatness once more. But the pink-haired emo girl will catch in his throat, as will the immense Starbucks sign in horrid American green. Gotina Kovas will tell her 6-year-old son, Naldo, about his dad, about the war, about how some dads don't come home and those who do never make it all the way back. She won't believe that Naldo understands how a piece of you can be forever broken, but Naldo will think back to winter, to those kids who stole his hat and gloves, think of how he ran and hid between 2 dumpsters. Coward, he would have called it, had he the word. And he'll cast a knowing look that will alarm her. She'll touch his cheek and smile. And at dusk, Alijwad Kazir will leave her Kabul home to gather landmines left over from one of the many invaders of her homeland. She will come upon a mine that is still alive, but it will not explode, and she will not be maimed or killed. She knows quite a lot about handling explosives. She will sell the mines to a group of Afghan insurgents who will use them to kill Corporals Derek Feynman and Penelope Holmes, U.S. Marine Corps. Will these things ultimately coalesce into some world-changing pattern, lead to a woman or man who will save or savage the world? Nobody knows that yet. Remember, this is a science fiction story about the day after tomorrow. And does it matter that these are all stories of war, so often fodder for our science fiction visions of the future? Perhaps, but other things will happen. Things less science fictional, more mundane. Gloria and Kathy Bennett will learn about Facebook and Instagram and inform their friends in the retirement community of Beech Oaks, Indiana, where computers are as ubiquitous as walkers. The Bennett sisters will at last find themselves in the 21st century they imagined as children. Children of the 1950s, immersed in rockets and atoms and eternal hope. And 50 years after abandoning playgrounds and front steps, they will find themselves once again connected with family and childhood friends, someone always there to read a boast or a complaint, more complaints now than they remember from those long-ago front steps, and the 2 Beech Oaks retirees will weep with joy only the once abandoned can feel. This joy will not last. This is not a future of life extension and immortality, and these women are old. Bill and Frank Stanislaw will close Stanislaw Brothers Deli, 22 years on the corner of Forbes and Smithfield in downtown Pittsburgh. Frank's kids are off on their own, and his wife Ellen has called in the markers. Time for leisure and travel, Ellen had told him, cruise brochure in hand. Bill could buy Frank out, but without his brother's lightning hands, he'd never keep up with the lunch rush. After locking up, Bill and Frank will stand outside the deli, staring wordlessly for half an hour. at 6:33 p.m. when they walk away from Stanislaw Brothers Deli for the last time, Bill and Frank will almost simultaneously get down to the business of hating Ellen. And at 11:55 p.m., in a suburban Little Rock bungalow, Booker Oatman, old at 50, will collapse onto his daughter's bed. The sheet and covers are black like the dress they'll have just buried her in, like his life would be from then until the end. The iPhone he'll hold is white, like her mother's wedding dress in her closet, like the blobs on Twyla's CAT scans. Tiny pictures will scroll on its screen, fisheye shots, the camera at arm's length, Twyla and Maurice grinning, Braxton High School behind them, Twyla in her bedroom, the boy's thumb tip obscuring half of the terror on her face. Twyla next to Booker in the hospital waiting room, hope in her eyes, but undeniable now with digital proof, doom in his own. If he could ever again catch Twyla and Maurice lovemaking in her bed, he would not rage like a defending father. He would embrace the both of them. It's right that she got to hold hands with a sweetheart. Right that she was hugged and kissed. Right, and this is hard for a father to admit, right that she had felt a man inside her body before that body failed her so completely. No miracle cure for Twyla, no revivification, no cloned body, no transference of mind and soul into a machine. This is just the day after tomorrow, and dead is dead is dead. Perhaps Booker and Maurice will bond over Twyla's death, an almost son slipping into the daughter's place. But this is not the far future, and people are only people, and, often as not, death drives us as far apart as we can go. Booker and Maurice might just as well never see each other again. Or maybe Booker will discover Facebook on Twyla's computer, build a virtual family with Gloria and Kathy of Beech Oaks, find relief in their age and wisdom. It might happen. Anything is possible, isn't it? No. For Booker and Gloria and Naldo and Di, most things will remain stubbornly impossible. This isn't a utopian future, is no future at all. This is a science fiction story about the day after tomorrow. We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.